Hi, this is Gary Cox, and as you know, I am the author of Don't Let Others Rent Space in Your Head. This is a no-frills, get-to-the-point program, so there's no music intro, professional announcers. We're not going to play around here. We're going to get right to it. Now, one quick word of caution. When you get to chapter 13, you've got a ways to go still, but when you get to chapter 13, that's where I discuss my four-step process that I use to change negative thinking or behavior. I want you to understand, if you're just going to be listening to me read the book to you, it might sound a little confusing because you don't have the book right in front of you. In other words, if I were to say to you, I want you to solve this problem, and here's the problem. What is 12 times 12 divided by 2 times 7,020? 29, add 2007, divide that by 3, multiply that times 3.79, and your answer is, well, that's just a little too much all at one time. You need to have your paper and pen in front of you, slow it down a little bit, get the calculator, and you could solve the problem. Without that calculator and the paper or pen, it could sound a little complicated. So when you hear me explain the four-step process, I don't want you to associate that, wow, this sounds a little complicated. Well, it may appear that way only because you don't have the book in front of you and you're unable to follow along with that. But the process is very powerful and it does work. So with that being said, let's continue now with the unabridged reading of the entire book of Don't Let Others Rent Space in Your Head. Don't Let Others Rent Space in Your Head, Chapter 0. Why Chapter 0? Because nobody ever reads the introduction of books. I guess you should just think of this chapter as the introduction that I'm strongly encouraging everyone to read. This material will help you tune in to the attitude and objectives of the book, and it tells you how and why I wrote it, so the body of the book makes more sense. The question. Every year, I talk to thousands of people. I regularly speak to audiences in convention centers and boardrooms all across the globe, and they come from every walk of life. And without exception, there is one burning question that I get more than any other. It's the one thing people tell me they most appreciate about what I teach. My life experience has led me to answer the question in ways that no one else does, and in fact, my answers often fly in the face of conventional wisdom and contradict other quote-unquote experts. My answer to the question are the reason I wrote this book, and my answers have changed my life and the lives of many who hear them. It's a great question, and I'm thrilled every time someone asks it because it means that they are ready to experience some incredible truths about happiness, success, and the richness life has to offer. Sometimes they use slightly different language. Sometimes they ask follow-up questions to more fully explain their query. But essentially, the question is, in spite of life's obstacles, how do you keep going? That's not a simple question, and there are lots of answers too. I've dedicated my life to understanding the answers to that question and then sharing those answers with others. I'm an avid aviation fan. I fly helicopters and airplanes, and I even hold a flight instructor's license, though I rarely have time to give lessons. When somebody asks me, how do you fly a plane? Unless I have a lot of time, I usually give them this short answer. You push the stick forward, and the houses get bigger. You pull the stick back, and the houses get smaller. When I have time to give lessons to a close friend, I enjoy having the opportunity to give the long answer. I especially enjoy watching my friend progress, and I experience the thrill of learning to fly all over again with each new experience that they have along the way. The short answer is cute and gets laughs, but the long answer is the one with all the true life's rewards. This book is a long answer. The reason I have taken the time to write this book is because the sincerity and value of the question, how do you keep going, truly deserves as thorough an answer as I can give. In these pages, we'll look at the question itself. We'll discuss some of the associated questions that cover topics like success, wealth, motivation, optimism, happiness, and positive thinking. But the real value in this book is the collection of real-world examples and tools you'll be given to keep yourself going and achieving for the rest of your life. Wordplay isn't the answer. Too often, people are willing to accept answers from self-styled quote-unquote experts who are clever with language or say things that seem quote-unquote deep. In the course of my career, I have found that adults often listen better if you use clever language or stories to get a point across. Think about all the speakers who motivate or inspire you. Most of them use great stories or clever wordplay to capture your attention and to help you remember their points. Unfortunately, too many people who have mastered the media and who have a magnetic personality have clever answers that don't do much for us in the long run. Now, don't get me wrong, I use stories too. They help people remember the points I'm trying to get across, and they make my points easier to understand. Anecdotes are a great training tool, but they aren't an end in themselves. It seems to me that simply making an observation about something and illustrating it with clever wordplay or a great story is the beginning and end from a lot of personal development experts. I see the need to go further. I always have tools or exercises to help people go beyond their current circumstances. I get some interesting feedback from people who hear me speak because my goal is developing and delivering tools that help real people in actual situations rather than simple motivation. Lots of public speakers love hearing praise about their events, and they are thrilled to hear that audiences are simply motivated. While that seems like a terrific result and it shows everybody loved the speaker, getting motivated really helps people accomplish any more than they would otherwise. Ultimately, it doesn't do much more than provide a short-lived, warm, fuzzy feeling like you get drinking a glass of wine. That's why I strive to look for tools that people can use to accomplish things once they feel motivated. Motivation is an important step along the way, but true progress comes from correct, consistent action, and motivation alone can lead to action, but not necessarily correct action. It's like pushing a parked car. You'll be active, but you won't be accomplishing anything. The tools you'll read in this book are designed to get you moving and continue in the right direction, and then keep achieving for the rest of your life. The beauty of getting going and working with these tools is that the results will start a momentum, and the right momentum will automatically motivate you to keep going and achieving. Your life will become an automatic self-improving cycle. Keep in mind, though, my toolkit is filled with dozens of useful tools, but every tool won't work in every situation. What's more, not every tool in the kit will even appeal to you. If you don't like a suggestion or a particular tool, you don't have to use it. Different personalities approach obstacles and life's problems. Notice I didn't call them challenges, but we'll discuss that later, in different ways. What you will find is that most of the methods I teach work for most people. Admittedly, I'm an action-oriented personality. I have a drive to accomplish things. This book isn't just for people who are driven, but I was only inspired to tackle my current profession when I was slammed by life experiences that brought me down, and I found myself asking the question, how do I keep going? Initially, I reasoned that there had to be lots of people who have been there before me, so I looked to experts for insights. I found dozens of platitudes and clever wordplay, but far too little substance that I could use to climb out of the place life had dragged me. I had been dealt an incredible amount of tragedy in a very short time frame, and the typical solutions weren't significant for me. One of the most annoying solutions suggested by friends and experts alike was to simply think positive. Some people think positive thinking feels good at first and seems to get you out of the really low places in life, but positive thinking was a lie and it didn't help me at all. I was so far down that positive thinking was amplifying how bad I felt. What's more, people suggested that positive thinking was an end in itself and that's all you need to do. That turned out to be as hollow as all the other answers people were giving. I think you'd agree, life's a bit more complicated than that. I still found myself asking, yeah, but how do I really keep going? I am where I am today because I had the good fortune to have a mix of very good and very bad experiences in my life, coupled with an interest in what drives people and the course of my faith. As an action-oriented personality, I was a true success story as an early teenager. And when all that I had worked for was gone in a few short months, I didn't just ask, how do I keep going? I followed up with a question, and how did I get here in the first place? Unlike most people who have problems in their life and work for years to get over their past, only to eventually chalk things up to a whole lot of bad luck and timing, I wanted to know more about the why. What was most frustrating to me was the fact that I did experience so many negative emotions in my life, and I didn't know how to change them. And what was even worse was not being able to understand how I got them in the first place. I didn't just want to know how to keep going, but I wanted to know everything about the experience so that I could master that situation and help others do the same. I came to the realization that it helps if you can identify how you came to feel a negative emotion. If this isn't done first, it's very difficult to change the emotion to something positive. What's worse than the negative emotions themselves is not knowing where they came from. At least if you know their source, you have somewhere to start. Think of this book as the result of my study of human behavior and a toolkit full of great strategies that you can use to help you in your own life. In it, I'll show you how to play games with your mind instead of your mind playing games with you. Interestingly, most people specifically avoid lingering too long on their bad experiences because it can be depressing. There is also some truth to the belief that whatever you focus on is what you will get out of life. Focusing on bad things can bring more bad things into your life. But I focused on my experiences, both good and bad, from a detached clinical perspective so I could work on mastering any circumstances life could throw at me. That's actually what many of my experiences help people do in order to help people master their own life. Wherever you are, that's where you need to start. Later in the book, you'll discover that I'm an action-oriented personality, and you'll find out how I have been beaten down by life circumstances so that low point is where I started. This is not a book of ways to simply overcome depression brought on by life circumstances, nor is it just a way to get rich or be successful, though it will help you with any of these ambitions or goals. There are tools in this book that can help anyone get to the next level, regardless of what that means. Are you ready to ask the question? More importantly, are you ready to take action when I tell you how to continue to keep going despite all obstacles? Over the next few hours or days as you read this book, you will find yourself inspired and motivated. You will find your view of circumstances in your life will change. Then in a few more days, weeks, or months, you'll see that life has improved and you will have overcome things that were keeping you back. You'll achieve more, feel better about yourself, and be more optimistic as you move forward. When you realize that your life is better, pick up this book again and read it once more. Two things will come from revisiting this text. First, you will reevaluate the tools you've used to get where you are, and you'll see that my suggestions are more than just words on a page and funny, memorable stories. This will crystallize in your own mind that these tools really do work, and you should be willing to try more of these ideas. The other thing that will happen is that you will be in a new place in your life, and you'll be inspired to try new tools, or maybe try the tools that worked earlier on new situations. Again, this is where my approach is truly different from others. Sometimes books tell you to come back every year or two and read again, but that's because their programs are based on rah-rah pump-up motivation. They want you to get re-energized and re-inspired. But remember, motivation is good and helps for a brief while, yet it takes more than motivation to progress in life. It takes the proper mindset and correct action to move forward and accomplish more. Because motivational programs don't offer many usable tools, you need to just read the motivational stories again. What's worse, you need to wait a year or so to give yourself time to forget the story so they re-inspire you when you read them the second time. When I ask you to come back, it's because I want you to see that the tools are working, and I want you to find new tools to apply to new situations. You may reread some stories that motivated you, made you think, or made you smile or cry, but that's not the reason to come back. In fact, you'll find the second time around, the stories do less motivating. It's the tools and your realizations about them that will help to keep you moving in the right direction. Psychologists have identified a part of the brain responsible for increasing your awareness. It's called the reticular activating system. You know how it is when you buy a new car, all of a sudden cars just like yours start appearing everywhere. This book uses the reticular activating principle to help you build momentum. You'll use examples and tools from this book, and when you come back, you'll use your newly increased awareness to do even more. Because my program is full of real practical devices for helping real people to move to the next level in their life, the true motivation you'll experience will come from a different, better place. Your future inspiration should come from your successes and perhaps some failures, not from my stories, and it will. What do most people want? Usually the question, how do you keep going, is preceded or followed by a question about how to accomplish something, buy something, win someone's affection, or get past a bad life experience. However one defines success or whatever it is they want out of life, desires are essentially driven by certain needs we all have in common. Understanding these needs will help you to refine your personal goals and understand which tools will work best for your needs. Most humans have several things in common. Considering that there are a few notable exceptions to these rules, usually associated with personality disorders, the following wants are shared by practically everyone. We want to be happy. We want to be healthy. We want to be loved by others. We want to have control of our own circumstances. We want to be successful. And to one degree or another, we want possessions. Usually desired possessions point back to one of our other wants because many times we believe these things will make us happy or reflect our success. And while that may seem true to one degree or another, in the long term, we need to resolve our wants differently. Ultimately, what must happen for people to achieve their own definition of happiness, love, control, success, and health is that we must truly master more than just obtaining the possessions we think we want. One of the real keys to happiness is to understand the entire process of personal achievement and all the success components as well. If you've read any books on success, time management, goal setting, increasing sales, or any topic remotely related to personal achievement, this truth isn't new to you. What's more, you have probably even read books or seen infomercials advertising programs that offer classes in how to reach some amazing level of personal happiness and success you only dream about. And if you've invested in a book or personal achievement program, you have already been exposed to a few of the ideas which most experts agree will help you reach your dreams or your sales goals or whatever the desires of your heart truly are. This book is different from all that have come before in two important ways. First, you will be given many more specific tools. In comparison to other programs, you can expect detailed information that takes you well beyond what positive thinking proponents suggest. Ultimately, positive thinking is little more than a simple tool that doesn't even work unless you've laid an appropriate foundation to be ready for it. And then you have to know what to do after positive thinking. And while I'm talking about positive thinking, let me just say this. When you hear some people talk, it seems as though the skills involved in positive thinking are relatively easy to master, and they can frequently make you feel good and overcome negative feelings in some situations. And because they make it sound so easy, it is an attractive, apparent solution. Unfortunately, most positive thinking proponents offer little beyond that particular false hope. The truth is, depending on your situation, positive thinking and affirmations can make you feel even worse. There may be a time and a place for positive thinking, but it's not as useful as most people believe. This book will show you when it does and doesn't work. This book will take you well beyond positive thinking and give you a comprehensive collection of tools, each with their own specific role to play along your journey of personal achievement, success, and increased happiness. But remember, I said that this book is different in two ways. Giving you a complete set of great tools and the necessary instructions to understand how they work and when to use them is only the first way this book is different. The second way this book is different is that it is far more grounded in reality than others. And before you finish reading the last page, you'll understand that you will need to do some actual work to accomplish your goals. If that doesn't sound intimidating enough, maybe this will. Though this book will help you achieve your definition of success and happiness, the unfiltered truth is bad things will still happen. You'll discover that the utopia promised by other self-help programs ignores the fact that life will continue to throw new obstacles in your path. No matter what you accomplish, you'll continue to ask, "How do I keep going?" If you want a book that promises to make you feel good about yourself or human nature, you can find dozens of them. Unfortunately, they don't deliver real-world results, and any good feelings you might experience won't last. Just remember, motivation alone may feel good for a little while, but rarely produces the results people rightfully demand in the long run. There's a maturity in wanting to pursue life goals in spite of the work it requires. If you've had enough of the feel-good philosophies and you're really finally ready to dig in your heels and accomplish your goals or whatever it takes to make your life worth living and always keep moving forward, then turn the page and get ready for a life-changing experience. In Chapter 0, we covered this book is about how to keep going in spite of problems and challenges. Clever sayings and stories are great if they help you remember something valuable, but too often experts try to motivate and inspire people with stories and clever words alone. You must go deeper. This book is a toolkit with ideas for overcoming obstacles and getting to the next level. Many popular answers are wrong, and this book will dispel myths and help you understand truths behind human nature. You need to understand the entire process of personal achievement in order to be able to truly achieve in your business and personal life. Depending on where you are in life, positive thinking may be counterproductive. Accomplishment requires work. This ends Chapter 0. Chapter 1. What does "don't let others rent space in your head" really mean? A big part of my life has been a study of the accomplishments of successful business people and how they got there. In the next chapter, you'll start to understand why, and you'll see how my motivations and strategies are considerably different from those of traditional life coaches and personal growth experts. I don't even consider myself a life coach, but that's another story. I've come to realize that people can accomplish more when they don't let other people or other things influence them in negative ways. I call it renting space in your head. The concept of allowing others to influence decisions and behaviors is not foreign to anyone over the age of four. It happens all the time. Entire industries like advertising, public relations, and financial advice are built on the principles of influence. Five-year-olds have even started practicing ways to get what they want by influencing their favorite grown-ups with powerful forms of cuteness or screaming like a banshee. If you want to accomplish more and move to the next level in your life, your goal should not only be to avoid letting other people rent space in your head, you must also avoid letting other things and even your own negative thoughts take up valuable space. It's my experience that our own negative thoughts often seem to be our own worst enemy. The more difficult we perceive our past to have been, the more we tend to let the resulting negative thoughts control our very being. And that controls our future. As humans, we have ideas, goals, relationships, and other things which we want to accomplish or pursue, but our future frequently gets smothered when we let something rent space in our head. One of the techniques I use when starting a speaking engagement is to begin with a thought-provoking question. Where would you be? What would you be doing? What would you have? And more importantly, how would you think differently if you didn't let anyone, anything, or your own negative thoughts from your past rent space in your head? Consider that question yourself. And by the way, if you're human, you do let things rent space in your head. That's just part of being human. But the degree or the amount of space that you have available for rent depends entirely upon you. A corollary to this principle is the rule of risk-taking. It goes like this. The more risk you take in life and in business, the greater tendency you will have to let others rent space in your head. It's largely because of the natural tendency people have to want cues about how they should respond to situations which are new to them. If you're trying something extraordinarily new or unique, and you're stretching well outside of your comfort zone, I call it taking risks, you'll look for reinforcement about your behavior. People who are incredibly successful have mastered the ability not to let others rent space in their head. They just want feedback about their risks, which is factual, and they don't attach emotional meaning to it. Maybe you've already started to limit the space you allow for negative thoughts, but if you truly master this concept yourself, you won't just be able to think outside of the box, you'll be able to consistently think way beyond it. Consider also, once you start down an unfamiliar path and take risks and look for feedback, if your results aren't as grand as you've imagined they should be, your mind may begin to let in negative thoughts. Not letting things rent space in your head is a never-ending process. It's a marathon that never ends. When Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, it's because he chose not to let the negative thoughts about what was impossible cloud his thinking. The 4-minute mile didn't rent space in his head. Imagine thinking so far out of the box that you're out of this world. That's exactly what Richard Branson has done. Branson is an incredibly gifted businessman, founder and CEO of Virgin Airways, Virgin Records, and he's a billionaire adventurer. Recently, he purchased not one, not two, but 6 space planes. I even feel a little bit silly writing that down. Richard Branson bought 6 spaceships. What do you think Richard Branson wants with 6 space planes? He wants to be able to take you to a hotel in space. Wouldn't you imagine that somebody hearing about the space planes and zero-gravity hotel rooms thought Richard Branson was whacked? Absolutely. But the truth is, commercial space travel is a reality and Richard Branson is benefiting from it. Do you think Richard Branson would have bought space planes or considered hotels in space if he let others rent space in his head? I'd like to introduce to you another forward-thinking person who doesn't allow people to rent space in his head. He's my business mentor, and I want to share a story about an amazing success he achieved because of the way he thinks. Power tip. We are the sum total of everything we have experienced from birth until now. Many years ago, he chose to enter the hotel business. He had absolutely no experience in the hotel industry, and that's just the beginning. The hotel property he bought was derelict and vacant. After going out of business, it sat empty for some time. Without even talking to the former owner, there were a few clues as to why it went out of business. The biggest clue was around 100 decibels, and that was the fact that the property was literally a stone's throw away from a runway of an international airport. Jumbo jets and all kinds of commercial and private planes land and take off all day long. That kind of noise obviously disturbed the guests. And there aren't many things louder than a jumbo jet at close range. Needless to say, many people thought it wasn't a good investment, especially for someone who was an air conditioner salesman. He was getting into a business he knew nothing about right across from a busy runway. People weren't shy, and more than one told this novice hotelier that his investment was not only unwise, they said it would never work. Some even thought he was crazy. Put yourself in his shoes. Would you leave the business that you know and invest and even borrow a huge amount of money in a hotel that had failed before? Not only that, it had remained empty for a long enough time that other hotel managers obviously knew about and passed on trying to rehab the property. Nobody wants to bet on a sure loser. If you look at it that way, it seems a bit scary. Instead of allowing other people to rent space in his head, this businessman pushed forward. He invested in redesigning the hotel and making it presentable for guests. He stayed focused on his goal and turned negative thoughts into neutral statements that he could manage. What about the noise? He didn't have the resources to close an international airport. Besides, even if he could, he wouldn't want to because travelers wouldn't be able to easily get to his beautiful resort. When you refuse to let other things and other people rent space in your head, you think on a totally different level. Today, if you visit this first-class resort, you'll still see and hear loud jets taking off, yet the resort couldn't be more successful. Unless you've been there, you're probably wondering how this property is a hit. What's absolutely amazing is that guests aren't even bothered by the noise. Even guests arriving at this beautiful resort actually participates in an orientation. This policy allows each guest to immediately become familiar with all the available restaurants, tours, activities, and amenities. That alone is thinking outside of the box. Part of the orientation includes a story about a special tradition everyone joins in whenever jets depart. Everyone stops what they're doing and waves at the plane to wish the folks that are leaving a safe journey. The staff promises you that when you leave, everyone will do the same for you too. You can even confirm this by looking down on the resort as you depart. What's even more clever is that because this is a romantic couples resort, staff suggests that each couple should kiss one another right after they wave to seal the wish. In this way, also, it becomes a romantic pastime rather than a noisy distraction. Brilliant. It's clever, and it works. Power tip. Are you willing to pay the price? Most people say they are, even if they don't know what the price is. Consider sitting at a table somewhere and every 5 minutes or so, something noisy happened that interrupted your nice dinner or conversation. That would be annoying. Yet at wedding receptions all across the country, there's a tradition of clanging glasses loudly until the new bride and groom kiss. It's loud and distracting, and if you're in the middle of a conversation, it would normally be annoying, but at the wedding reception, everyone in the room is smiling and happy. It's a new way to think about the noise. My mentor's luxury couples resort would never have been successful, much less launched a nationally recognized chain of resorts, without quite a bit of unique thinking in new ways and not letting others rent space in his head. His name is Gordon Butch Stewart, and you'll learn more about him later. So let's assume you agree. Herein lies the challenge. How do you get to a point where you limit the amount of space that things rent in your head so you can make phenomenal things happen in your own life? Well, read on, because that's the point of this book. Maybe you can accept this logically, but you'll need to go further and internalize this new way of thinking. You need to adopt this new mindset emotionally as well as logically. For example, I can't tell you how many times I've heard a sales manager speaking to someone new to sales and using a statement like, "It's just a numbers game." They say, "The more people you talk to, the closer you are to a sale." Duh! We can all understand that logically, but thoughts like this don't matter to someone who has never been there, someone who has never made a sale in the first place. They haven't made the mental connection because they don't have any positive experiences talking to enough people, which eventually convert to sales, in the past to build on. Telling a new sales recruit that the more no's they get, the closer to a yes they are, is like telling someone, if you keep eating junk food, you're going to die. Well, duh again. They may intellectually understand this, but it takes more than a clever statement for it to click. One of my goals in this book is to show you how to move forward and make monumental leaps so you can experience phenomenal personal and professional success even before you've experienced the joys of a success on your intended path. What's more, I'll give you tools so you'll be able to recognize the steps you ought to take to develop your own logical plan of action. From time to time, we all have doubts or insecurities, but there is something which is within incredibly successful people which helps them refuse to reward their negative thoughts. They simply don't let others rent space in their heads. This is one of the keys to their success. One thing you'll need to be careful about is trying to create these mindsets when you're at a low point in your life. The time to master this skill isn't when you're down and out. If you are down right now while you're reading this, don't put the book down and give up. There are all kinds of tools and strategies in this book, and some will help you get up enough and change your attitude so you can employ this strategy. Just as you know, I'm not talking about positive thinking. A few chapters from now, you'll start to see that I absolutely don't believe in traditional positive thinking. Positive thinking would tell us that we should say, the more no's you get, the closer to a yes you are. As I said, that only works for people who are ready to hear it because they have experienced a positive result. When it comes to a person who doesn't believe a statement on an emotional level, you can tell them until you're blue in the face, but they're going to fight it all the way. They'll hate the process, and it won't last long. So what about you? It's time to ask yourself that important question. Where would you be? What would you be doing? What would you have? And how would you think differently if you didn't let anyone or anything, even your own negative thoughts or experiences, rent space in your head? And if you're intrigued, remember, you have the control. Just turn the page. You'll take control of your journey. In Chapter 1, we covered, people can accomplish more when they don't let other people or other things influence them in negative ways. I call it renting space in your head. Both people and things can influence your behavior. People and things rent space in your head because we are looking for feedback about what we're doing. If the results of our efforts seem less than perfect, it's natural to look for problems and let our negative interpretations influence us to react in negative ways. It's inevitable that some people and things will influence your thinking, so you must practice in order to recognize things that influence you and to decide which things to evict from your sphere of influence, and what to keep. You can control your journey by controlling the things that influence your behavior. This ends chapter 1. Chapter 2. Inquiring minds don't even believe it. Understanding my background. My life story isn't the purpose of this book, but it is important because it helps many people understand where I'm coming from. I have found that people use all kinds of excuses when they're getting good, solid advice, and one of the biggest excuses is that I personally don't know what it's like to be really down. The fact is, I do. And when you hear some of the unbelievable things I've been through, you might feel bad for me. Don't. I'm able to look at my life clinically, and my experiences are all part of who I am. I love my life. I love having the chance to help other people master the problems and roadblocks in their lives too. My past is what has allowed me to understand essential human truths and master my perceptions to move on and continue to the next level. I don't watch much television, but when I see what passes for drama on TV these days, it makes me laugh. I guess I've had enough real-world drama in my own life that the TV kind just doesn't do anything for me. From a very early age, I knew I wanted to be in business. I was fascinated by the idea that I could create something that was valuable enough to other people that they would pay money for it. To a degree, playing and school were a regular part of my childhood, but my real excitement was always when I was doing something toward my business. I was just 11 when I noticed that people were carrying beaded keychains and they would buy just about anything made of macrame. The 70s were memorable for more than just leisure suits. I learned how to make macrame keychains because I could make them quickly and people were buying them almost as fast as I could make them. Before the keychain market dried up, I started looking for something a bit more unique and something that could generate even more profit. I discovered that I could carve black coral and create fine jewelry pieces that were even more profitable than the keychains. My entrepreneurial interests were only just beginning, but the rewards were great. Now keep in mind, this isn't a business book, and I'm not trying to teach you how to start or run a business, but I want you to have some insight to my personality. By the way, there isn't much market for beaded keychains anymore. I was, and I am, a driven, action-oriented person, and I love business and the rewards that came from it. I was regularly making a profit that grown-ups would have envied, and I didn't know it was supposed to be hard. Unfortunately, I had a less than amicable relationship with my stepfather, and my ability to out-earn him seemed to provide a reason for even more alienation. One more thing that I should mention here is that I haven't yet used the term type A personality. I've come to understand that people's perceptions of certain words or phrases can cause them to believe or behave in certain ways. In my mind, the term type A has negative connotations, and these bad perceptions are part of the popular lexicon as well. Because some people already have a negative view of type A personalities, I don't want to say that's what I am. For example, I think some type A people are being driven to the point where they lack balance in their lives. I may be driven, I push harder than most people do in certain situations, but I have balance in my life, and I value my family and my church life too. I took my success with jewelry to the next level by adding jewelry repair to my business. And based on my ability to repair and even create jewelry, I started to sell new customized fine jewelry too. I wasn't following in the family business or doing what a family mentor suggested. I just liked being in business, and the jewelry business came from a natural progression of my entrepreneurial experiences. I simply enjoyed being my family's first generation jeweler. When I was in high school, I entered the school's work experience program, and I tried to work for someone else part-time. That didn't work at all. I am now certain exactly which side of the fast food counter I never want to see again. Business thrilled me, but hourly grunt work didn't. The intellectual payoff wasn't there. I went back to my principal, and I negotiated a deal. Most public schools receive a fixed amount of funding from the government according to the number of students who are enrolled. Whenever students leave or drop out, the school loses thousands of dollars. At the end of my junior year, I told my principal that I simply hated school and I planned to leave. I also told him that I knew he would lose some funding if I did, so I suggested a compromise. I suggested that he allow me to work for myself full-time, and rather than spend any school resources on my curriculum and grades, I would grade myself and ultimately earn my diploma and graduate with my class at the end of the year. Without a single question or time to consider my proposal, he simply agreed. During my senior year, I never set foot on school grounds. I ran my business full-time. I earned my diploma, and you'll be happy to know that I got a perfect 4.0 GPA. While just about every high school senior would love to grade themselves and never have to take a class, my business wasn't an excuse to get out of school. It was an enterprise. I even hired some of my classmates, and I was bringing in over $1,000 a week. Needless to say, I got great grades my senior year. By society's standards, I was doing very well. I had a great sports car, a solid income, and a growing jewelry business. I was able to buy things lots of adults would only dream about owning, and I even married my high school girlfriend. I was proud of what I had accomplished, and things never looked better. In retrospect, I thought this game called life was pretty easily mastered, and I wasn't sure what all the fuss was about. Nothing had prepared me for what I was about to discover. My wife got pregnant and eventually gave birth to a boy who had to be placed in intensive care for 2 weeks. I had never even been around anyone who needed hospital care, and my new boy's birth started a storm of emotions I was totally unprepared to handle. I was blessed and challenged, I was happy and scared, and above all, I was confused. I didn't know what to do or how to feel, but I probably could have handled this curveball somehow. Then my wife confessed that the son I had loved since before he was born wasn't mine. I was devastated. It felt like somebody had pulled my heart out of my chest and rubbed it against a cheese grater. The pain was so intense. I was still confused and deeply emotional, but I felt that somehow I should start looking for a way to overcome this tragic set of circumstances. I had only begun to come to grips with my situation and was still far from getting past the pain and confusion when my father was brutally murdered. My grandfather and stepfather died of cancer. And my uncle was killed in a plane crash. All this happened before I turned 21. When this had all started, I had $30,000 in the bank. When I took stock of everything that had happened, I lost my family members, friends, all my money, and my $100,000 a year business. I was just out of my teens. I was suicidal, and it seemed like I had good reasons to be. In fact, I had to be hospitalized and put on medication for a time. I guess it's kind of ironic, but my life was so incredibly bad that the National Enquirer even ran a full-page story about my success and tragedy. I know the reputation of the National Enquirer, but I assure you, they didn't even invent any of the details you've just read. Coming back was a different process. As you've already guessed, I did eventually recover from my downward spiral, but it's important to understand there was no specific aha moment for me. There was no one thing I read or heard that helped me suddenly overcome my pain and start achieving again. In some ways, I was doing what you might expect. I was depressed and I drank a lot. I had adopted a hermit lifestyle and listened to depressing music that reinforced my negative outlook. I thought I needed time to absorb what had happened, but in a few key ways, I was different too. I had experienced some terrific successes early in my life, and my passion for business was being rewarded. I had the memories of that success, and I found myself focusing on them as a means to overcome my present dim view of things. I reasoned that I had managed to succeed in business once, so I decided to tackle business again. I was able to succeed in business again in a relatively short time, but I must admit that achieving a measure of wealth again was far easier than trying to be normal again. Business was natural enough for me so that success afforded me the time I needed to spend focusing on what makes people normal. I had a burning curiosity to discover how we function as humans, and more importantly, I needed to understand how I could bounce back as quickly as possible. After all these tragedies, I was riddled with powerful psychological limitations. Fear of failure, fear of success, fear of falling in love again, losing family, and the list goes on. Again, no earth-moving revelations here. I just started making little improvements in my life. I opened the shades on my trailer to cast out the dark and let in the light, and then opened the windows to let in fresh air. I started to listen to more positive, upbeat music, and I realized it was the little things that made the biggest difference for me. I kept studying my situation and comparing where I was to where I wanted to be. I rekindled my faith. I let friends know that I had opened my windows and changed my music and that I was going to succeed after all. My friends and family were happy that I had re-entered the world and I was doing well in business again, and I started hearing the question, "Gary, how do you keep going?" It was then that I discovered the true pleasure of sharing my discoveries with others. Traditional self-help just helps the author. One of my revelations was that there wasn't much out there on how to keep going in spite of life tragedies. To me, it seems that lots of the positive thinking books crowding the shelves don't help anyone but the author. Now, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with writing a book to make money, but if the stated intent of the book is to help people and the techniques haven't been proven over time, or if they might just do more harm than good, then that's when I have a problem. As for the information that can help people overcome tragedy or simply move from a good place to a better one, I found very few practical answers there. I honestly don't think most of the positive thinking proponents have ever done much more than read a few books and reword someone else's philosophy on optimism. In Chapter 2, we covered, just in case you think that Gary is just one more self-help expert with letters after his name whose actual experience is limited to the postgraduate classroom, you're wrong. The personal tragedy I've experienced may be amazing, but I never use it as an excuse to give up. This ends Chapter 2. Chapter 3. Okay, you can rent space in your head, but only to good tenants. Have you ever stopped to take the time to figure out why you act or think the way you do? The results or lack of results in your life? I mean, have you ever been able to identify a specific moment that happened in your life, especially as a very young child, that influences your actions and personality to this very day? We're essentially the product of everything that we have ever experienced in our lives from birth to this very moment. Life experiences and relationships have greatly influenced our behaviors, thought processes, and many of our actions. Our lives have been a compilation of things learned from our culture, parents, grandparents, schooling, teachers, and religion, not to mention genetics. Now, you can't change your genetics, so let's focus on the environmental influences, because those can be changed and updated. Even when you wake up, you have a specific pattern you start with every day. It's usually the same one over and over and over. You've been engaged in it for years, and it has evolved from being a habit to being a ritual. It's almost as though you're on autopilot. There are things that each of us do every day because someone or something programmed us. A tremendous amount of this type of programming happened to you as a child. I often try to identify why I think, act, and do what I do, and try to see if I can remember specific experiences that happened which caused me to respond in ways that I do. For example, I remember when I was about 9 or 10 years old, I was spending the weekend with my grandparents, and we were all sitting at the dinner table playing Monopoly. We got to the point where I was losing pretty badly. I was frustrated, and I threw my dice onto the board. I didn't launch them at anyone. It wasn't a vicious throw, but it was obvious I was angry. I'll never forget what happened next. My grandfather immediately folded the board in half, put everything away, and said, "We don't play that way." I looked at him in astonishment. I was used to getting second chances at school, so I expected him to give me another chance. Just unpack the game and we'll start over. Not a chance. The rule was, we don't play that way. That's it. I'll never forget that. The lesson, don't be a sore loser. A great lesson indeed. Consider my grandfather's approach. He didn't pull the new age parenting garbage and, you know, tell me we needed to talk about my feelings and why I threw the dice. He didn't give me another chance and offer to keep playing if I would just promise not to throw the dice or have some other temper tantrum. If he did, what would have been my answer? I had promised not to misbehave and likely would have even stuck to my promise for that day and maybe even for the rest of the weekend. I didn't get a second chance. Power tip. We do everything in life for usually one of only two reasons. Because we want to or because we have to. Take what you have to do and make it something you want to do, and life becomes more enjoyable. What I realized was another lesson. Don't give in. Tough love has its place, and my grandfather's example stuck with me to this day. Now, there will be some who read this story who feel sorry for me as a child or think that there might be a gentler way to get the same point across. Consider, though, this was just a board game. Consider as well, if I had been given a second chance, I probably wouldn't have remembered the lesson this long. I can see the incident in my mind's eye as if it happened yesterday. It's like a video I can run anytime I want. I've played this video over and over. The video in my mind is no more than about 5 seconds. I get upset and throw the dice, the board game gets folded, and I hear, "We don't play that way." What's interesting about things like this is that we all have been programmed like this. It happened all the time when you were young, and it still happens, though somewhat less frequently and intensely, to adults. It has to do with survival behavior. We learn what it takes to get the results we want or need, and we remember lessons, both negative and positive. Ironically, we usually forget the core reason we develop certain thought patterns, and sometimes we don't even realize the core belief that resulted from it. We just react a certain way because of what we learned or believe to be true. The problem is that when we receive the original programming, our ability to draw the correct conclusion from the situation may have been limited or inadequate. As an adult, with an ever-growing collection of experiences, we should regularly review our beliefs and original lessons if we can remember them and see if the lessons are true and if the beliefs are helping us. If not, it's time to look for new lessons and experiences to replace the bad ones. As you'll learn later in this book, when you can identify a limiting belief and change it, you'll begin to get a new result immediately. It's an exciting realization that's the point of my book and my seminars. Fortunately, I remember this story about my grandfather. I remember the video. I remember the lessons. I still hold the resulting beliefs. I am certain that I have many more positive lessons where I don't recall their origin and couldn't find the video for the life of me. On the other side of the coin are the negative programming experiences. I guess when I was a child, I might have considered that lesson a negative experience, but the negative is so small in proportion to my life and the positive so large that I consider this a positive memory. As you can imagine, I have a tremendous amount of footage on file of negative lessons. Just as we allow positive experiences to program us, we certainly allow negative ones to do the same. The sad thing is that in spite of the fact that we are a product of our experiences and lessons, we can't consciously remember a fraction of the experiences that are responsible for programming us. This means, unfortunately, much of our programming has been subconscious or is played out in our behaviors subconsciously. Unless we take action to control our programming, we're like a kite in the wind. We just get blown around and we're at the mercy of the direction and velocity of the wind. If you can master your circumstances and your life, there must come a time that you say, stop. This is all a choice. I can allow or not allow this negative or positive experience to affect my life, to rent space in my head. If you need just one more little reason to embrace change and squeeze more out of life, consider this. Life is so empty and unfulfilling when everything and everyone controls you. Freedom of choice and freedom to succeed are enriching on so many levels, and the realization that these freedoms are a matter of choice can be incredibly empowering. Your mind is like owning real estate. Some people are great investors and landlords, while others are not. Good investors own quality properties with good tenants, and the value of their properties or investments goes up. One of the keys to having good tenants within your portfolio is in your pre-qualifying process. If you don't pre-qualify properly, you are going to have bad tenants. Then there are times that no matter how well you pre-qualify, you may still have to evict people. The longer you wait to evict them, usually the more repairs and cleanup you're going to have. Putting off evicting bad tenants also devalues your property and keeps you occupied with troubles and worries that waste your valuable time and money. If you realize that you need to spend time pre-qualifying your tenants and quickly evict the bad ones that slip through, you'll be a successful investor. Master that concept, and it will yield great results. We all have space in our heads for rent. It's our choice who we rent to, good tenants or bad. Unfortunately, many people forget, while others don't even realize, that there is truly a choice. As we discussed earlier, we have been subjected to so much programming, especially while growing up, when we were too young and too inexperienced to decode the associated choices. Then as we get older, what has been ingrained in our minds manifests itself in the results we experience. As we grow older, we must realize that we need to be responsible for our own actions. This means that we should try to deprogram much of the junk and limited thought processes that so many of us are exposed to. The process takes time and can be a truly monumental effort, but the payoff is worth it. Power tip. Learn to play games with your mind instead of your mind playing games with you. If an investor purchases an occupied apartment building, with that purchase he gets all the tenants that come with the building. Chances are that they are not all great tenants. From a business perspective, what should the new owner do? He may have to evict some tenants, which takes time, money, and it can be a real headache. He may just wait until the tenant's lease is up and not renew it with the hopes to find a better replacement. I've had to say, the large majority of adults today have buildings with bad tenants. You've heard the stories. I've had a hard life, a terrible upbringing. My mother or father or friend did this or that or treated me this way or that way. You need to start realizing that the experiences in your life that cause you to believe and behave as you do are lessons that may have been misinterpreted, or they may altogether be wrong. Okay, after you admit it, what's next? We need to go through each tenant lease in all of our mental property and make a choice, a conscious choice, as to who we're going to keep and who needs to be evicted. Remember, the longer you wait to evict, the more problems and expense you'll experience. Because we're talking about limited ideas and beliefs and not causing someone's homelessness, and because there are no contracts in place forcing you to retain bad ideas or tenants, you should feel good about getting rid of bad tenants as soon as possible. Essentially, your goal here is to allow helpful beliefs and ideas to remain in your mind while quickly dismissing, evicting, limiting, or incorrect beliefs. Notice I didn't say to evict negative thoughts. That's because negative thoughts can be as powerful as positive thoughts if their influence provides desired outcomes. That's the whole point of chapter 10. Don't worry if it's not apparent how to accomplish this right away. That's what section 3 of this book is for. It's important for now that you just try to understand the foundational principles. I use a variation on this concept in running my business. When I'm involved in the interview process for a management or upper management candidate, I let them know that I never want to rent unnecessary space in my head. I tell them that they are most important to me if they don't rent space in my head as part of their day-to-day job. For example, if I have to delegate 5 projects or responsibilities to them and they drop the ball on one, I am now thinking about that problem plus which other ball they might have dropped. My team understands that they get paid, so I don't have to think about their job. If an employee starts developing a track record of dropping the ball and renting too much space in my head when I wonder if they've done their job, then there's a problem. If the problem persists, there's an eviction notice. It would be like dating someone and discovering that they've cheated on you. They may be truly sorry and never do it again, but it's always in the back of your mind renting space. Whether it's dating or an employee, you shouldn't just let things slide. You've got to eliminate things that rent space in your head so you can use that space for thoughts that are helpful and productive. If you know someone who micromanages people, this concept of employees renting space in your head doesn't apply. That's because micromanagers are in the habit of letting staff rent space in their head and following up behind them. It's no wonder micromanagers are usually quite busy while they contribute very little of value to the bottom line. They usually try to hire people who need to be micromanaged because it fits their mold. In the beginning, many employees may need some degree of hand-holding. But after a while, a good manager should step progressively further back and let the employee do their job. Micromanaging also tends to alienate good employees, and they will seek employment where they can do a job and be appreciated for their accomplishments. People need to have space to be creative and even make mistakes. The bottom line is that you have beliefs that produce reactions and results. Be they negative or positive, some of your beliefs are good tenants and worth keeping, while others are worthless and can't be evicted fast enough. Later in the book, we'll talk about the eviction process and where to find new tenants to take their place. For now, you should try to establish a solid pre-qualifying process for new tenant candidates. Whenever you have an experience that has an emotional impact on you, decide if the lesson you think you've learned and the ensuing belief that results is a helpful belief for your future. You can rent space in your head, but don't let the first applicant have the place. Pre-qualify and only let the really good ones in. In Chapter 3, we covered, we react to things because of our culture, parents, grandparents, schooling, teachers, religion, and genetics. It will help if you consider why you react in certain ways. Childhood experiences can influence you for a lifetime. You can use your intellect to overcome and reprogram your natural reactions. Recognizing and analyzing your beliefs is the first step toward being able to control and manage them in your own best interest. This concludes Chapter 3. Chapter 4. You can't change what you don't acknowledge. I can remember times when something strange went wrong with my car, and then the problem cleared up by itself. Then it came back, and it went away again. It seems like car problems frequently go away just as you're pulling up to the service department. The annoying thing is, now you have to hope your car will start having the mechanical problem again while it's in for service so the mechanic can witness the problem and fix it. What's even more irritating is that you're going to get charged by the mechanic even if he doesn't find and fix the real problem. Unfortunately, you can't get too mad at him because he can't be expected to fix a problem that doesn't appear to be there in the first place. It's really nothing more complicated than you can't fix what doesn't appear to be broken. Or, put another way, you can't change what you don't acknowledge. Have you ever tried to talk to a friend about a personality flaw that they have, which everyone else sees except them? It's hard to even bring up things like that because you don't want to hurt their feelings. But the real problem is if they don't recognize the problem to begin with, you usually have to be so forceful in your statements that you're in danger of jeopardizing that relationship. If their denial is especially strong, they'll just think you're nuts or hypersensitive or just plain mean. This same mentality applies to departments, sales teams, divisions, companies, and even entire industries. I'm sure if you thought about it for just a few minutes, you could come up with someone in your company who just doesn't get it. But if they did, it could change their world. A friend of mine related an experience like this, which happened recently with a leading software company. As part of an independent training company, he was teaching a 3-hour seminar on how to use a particular program. There were approximately 500 people in the audience, and one of the management folks from the software company was invited to attend. After watching most of the session, she complained that the training was well over the heads of the audience and the training was too expert, quote unquote, and didn't appear to be directed to the proper target market. Ironically, every single feedback form turned in by attendees that day was overwhelmingly positive about the training. Not one single attendee said the material was over their head or that the trainer was hard to understand. My friend invited the manager from the software company to look over the feedback forms as soon as they were collected from exiting patrons so she could see that he wasn't just showing her selected responses. She was mouth open amazed. She simply couldn't believe that every attendee was thrilled. She was astonished that some independent training company understood the end user so much better than a professional from the company that actually makes the software. The backstory on this particular situation is that the software company wasn't convinced that some independent trainer could present their program as well as the manufacturer could. The training company could have bragged about their abilities all day long and never convinced the software maker of their skills. Even when the software company sent an actual representative to review the training in person, she still wasn't convinced. Only after seeing the unfiltered responses from attendees was she finally convinced. The relatively small software training company got a contract with a major software maker because of the real-world experience. Until then, the software maker wasn't willing to acknowledge that some outside training company could possibly present their product better than the manufacturer could. They only changed their opinion when, in the face of overwhelming evidence, they were forced to acknowledge it. The saddest thing I often see is people who attend seminars or read books which offer solid, helpful, insightful information, yet they don't go far enough with their beliefs. They may agree with everything. They think, yep, that's good stuff. I agree with that for sure. But their life is in total disarray. Their professional life reflects the gap between agreement and action as well. Agreeing to all this great stuff on an intellectual level is one thing. Believing it is another. To me, believing means that you move from intellectualizing something to internalizing it. Some people don't want to believe because belief requires action, and action usually takes people out of their comfort zone. Some people put off acknowledging because they would have to make a change, and people are frequently uncomfortable with change. Another problem is that in order to acknowledge and change, you have to admit that what you're doing isn't working. Admitting that you are wrong is simply beyond some people. Regardless of the reason people don't want to recognize their problems, it comes down to the simple concept of denial. People in denial don't want to acknowledge things because it might be too painful. Whether it's conscious or subconscious, not everyone prefers to be in denial. Some people find it more painful not to change. For some people, myself included, not acknowledging and not growing is more painful than denial. Whenever the results you're getting aren't consistent with your goals, the next logical step should be to look for ways to change, or at least look for ways you can be more open to change. Even though denial may offer the appearance of a benefit, in that you avoid problems in the short term, denial and procrastination simply don't provide consistent, positive outcomes in the long run. What's more, Procrastination leads to an unfulfilling lifestyle. If you want to live a rich, full life, you've got to commit to eliminating procrastination as much as possible. This is the end of CD 1.